On a Monday, it is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin ranks 30th in the nation for broadband coverage, according to the consumer site Broadband Now. A 24-member task force is supposed to tackle long-standing connectivity issues in our state. Here's Governor Evers announcing the task force earlier this month.
Now more than ever, a strong state economy depends on access to high-speed internet for our schools, businesses, hospitals, and homes.
How is internet access where you live? Do you struggle to find high speeds at home or work? Is your business hurt by gaps in high-speed internet? We're at 800-642-1234. Governor Evers appointed Brittany Beyer to lead the new task force on broadband access. She is executive director of Grow North Regional Economic Development Corporation based in Rhinelander. And joining us, I may point out, from a trusty landline. Brittany, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me back.
Well, last month, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation put out a report where broadband is throughout this whole report and the need for accessible, affordable broadband. It called it, you know, not moonshot to fix this. Do you agree with that characterization?
I do agree. I think we have to think about it a little bit differently. I think we have a couple of different examples in other states that we can follow. But I do agree that it's imperative that we fix this as soon as we can.
Okay, so what are the barriers here? What is causing us not to be able to get broadband universally across Wisconsin?
I think it's a population density issue. I think most of the 72 counties in the state of Wisconsin are 25% or more rural populations. So a lot of the larger providers just don't have the financial benefit from putting out that infrastructure just right away. And the way that we would have to go about incentivizing it at the municipal level, we just have to think about it just slightly differently, because it's not easy enough for our local municipalities to take the lead on grants. And cooperatives and the smaller providers need a little bit more support, along with our larger providers, figuring out how they can all work together.
Okay, so why should there be a task force? Why is a task force needed to study this issue?
There are so many conversations happening at the same time. Having a task force that is their role is to pull some of those conversations together. And the list of different members is pretty impressive. So when you have those people at the table thinking through the problem, I think we'll be able to at least have some clearer short-term goals. And then with the report in about a year, we'll have some better ideas going forward as well.
So a report in about a year, that's not going to help the 45,000 children who can't log into internet to get their classes this fall.
I agree. And that's why this has been moved up so clearly. I think COVID-19 and the closures really brought this back to the forefront. Since taking over this position, it was extremely clear that for our rural communities, internet is absolutely an imperative thing to fix as soon as we can. And we'll try to do the best as we can. I think we have to have some real-world fixes, offline fixes, especially for education, going forward for the fall. But let's see what we can do. There might be some short-term fixes.
We're talking about internet access across Wisconsin with Brittany Beyer, who's heading a new task force formed by Governor Evers. You can join in. Do you have internet problems where you live? How is access? Do you struggle to find high speeds at home or where you work? Is your business being compromised because of gaps in high-speed internet? How is your company affected? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Brittany, you know, you can break this down in several ways: accessibility, affordability, quality. Which of these needs should rise above everything else? What is most urgent here to attack this issue?
I think accessibility by far is the thing that we have to tackle. First off, there's so many people who are on what is termed the last mile, and they're not necessarily getting the coverage Once we have that, we'll be able to help build out the infrastructure. But right now, that infrastructure is just not getting to enough people.
So the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, says 93% of Wisconsin consumers have access to high-speed internet. How important is increasing that rate?
Well, the rate of so the FCC's deemed speeds are probably a couple years behind what has become commonplace. So when everyone is at home right now because of COVID-19, the upload-download speeds that families need or individuals or businesses, it's just accumulating and it's not going to stop accumulating. So, you know, the FCC is going to be doing some more work coming forward on setting new regulations. But right now, you know, businesses need more access. Families need to make sure that when they have multiple kids sitting on tablets doing the work, and you're probably working from home as well, that you have enough bandwidth to do the work.
Is the return on investment worthwhile if expanding access to a small number of people in, say, Land O'Lakes would require very expensive changes to the state's networks?
Well, that's what the problem that we're seeing. The larger providers are not necessarily able to do that work because they're not going to have that return. So how does the state itself then supplement and become partners to finish off that work? We also have hundreds of local providers that are the ones that are actually doing the boots-on-the-ground work for a lot of our communities. I definitely have a few in my own region. And we need to help support them. We need to have the larger providers at the table so that we can all work together to figure out how to close these gaps that are just in too many places around the state.
Let's bring in Steve now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, good morning. Everyone who's listening to this program knows that net access should be a public service provided just as electricity was provided 100 years ago. Should be provided without regard to return on investment for private industry, and it's obviously that viewpoint is being absolutely excluded from the conversation by the private interests who are intent on profiting from this program. So where is that viewpoint that internet access should be a public service? Where is that in the whole debate?
Steve, thanks.
Yes. Well, what you want to think about is that it is a utility, and that decision comes from the federal government. So that's also another point to be made, that has to be a federal decision, and that's also related to how the federal government then funds and makes decisions about different programs for the whole entire country. But you're absolutely right. It should be considered a utility.
And as a utility, then, for, you know, the Public Service Commission voted to extend its moratorium on electric, gas, and water disconnections for customers. Would you lump internet in with that?
Well, that's, again, that has to be a federal switch and change that we're kind of working on and pushing in certain ways. I believe that's a very good point as well, but you also saw a lot of the providers jump to the forefront during COVID-19 closures, and they offered broadband connections where they hadn't before. So I think there's a goodwill effort that we can really benefit from right now, and this is exactly the time to do the work.
We're talking about a new governor's task force to address broadband access in the state. It's chaired by Brittany Beyer, the executive director of Grow North Regional Economic Development Corporation. With your insights as well, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute. More Stay Cap here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about a governor's task force to look at broadband issues. The FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, released its broadband deployment report last month. said more than 5.4 million residents now have access to broadband. Here's a member of the task force, Theron Rutna, IT director for the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa.
There's nowhere in Wisconsin where the digital divide, lack of broadband access, is more acute than in Indian Country.
How important is high-speed internet to your family or job? Why does it matter to have broadband at your home? Join in 800-642-1234. And the chair of the governor's 24-member task force, Brittany Beyer, stays with us. Brittany, we just heard there from the IT director for the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, talking about access. Why does this digital divide exist?
I think that there's been this desire to have the market fill in the gap and do the work for a very long time, and we're just not seeing it in the way that it can be done quickly. It's also extremely expensive to build out this type of infrastructure, and although this governor has given $48 million in the last budget, $24 million has already been given in grants, and the next $24 million is slated to be granted by, well, the grants are due in December. The amount of work that needs to be done in all of these small pockets, again, because it's last mile, there just needs to be a different overall picture of the need. And that goes to some really interesting points about mapping and how we're thinking about it as a state initiative with some fresh eyes. And that's what the task force will do.
Why should the state spend its tax dollars and these grants on high-speed internet projects rather than leave these costs to the companies that profit from providing internet?
Well, it's an interesting question, but what I've seen is the grant dollars are actually matched by local dollars, and there's real initiatives and real reasons that our local community should be playing a part inside of this. For every house that has internet connection, the value increases, which means that there's more taxes coming into the community. So there's this loop all around where everyone who is at the table is actually benefiting from it. It is a good way of building out the local infrastructure by using a local provider, because there is this real interest in helping the community. That's something that we've seen. But I think this is a moment where because COVID-19 is really shining the head on the need for broadband, the larger providers can then come to the table and also really play a part of it. And let's be honest, even if you're a large provider, the expense of this is really quite daunting. So when you are working with a state that's going to help incentivize that build out, we just need to make sure that this is getting done.
Gail wrote to say, I live in the North Woods and my internet is so bad that I cannot upload even one single picture to an email, nor can I upload one picture to Facebook. Paying the high price for such an awful connection, Gail says, is really upsetting. How is there enough competition among internet providers in Wisconsin?
I believe there's competition, but we're also not necessarily some of the voices saying exactly just that somehow weren't just getting to the right ears. And that was something that we were feeling pre-COVID-19. You know, some of the ways that we've made that point is to bring in somebody, you mentioned Land O'Lakes, while asking somebody to make a cell phone call from downtown Land O'Lakes, and there's just not the coverage. And those individuals would be gobsmacked by the fact that they couldn't do that. And so often, because people weren't necessarily living in those conditions, they weren't necessarily thinking that policy shifts needed to be made, or even just how the infrastructure build-outs were really thought as a cohesive whole. It's just something that we need to, as the task force does the work, really take that opinion and try to close that gap.
We're discussing internet access with Brittany Beyer, who is leading a new task force formed by Governor Evers. You can join in. When did you first get access to high-speed internet? How has it changed your life? We're at 800-642-1234. We heard from Gary in Iron River writing in to say, I live in Bayfield County. We have good fiber optic high-speed internet, have a small local telephone company. The area is not economically robust and is completely rural, Gary says, with many seasonal residents and small villages. Prices are fair. If our little company can do it, why is this problematic elsewhere?
I think that's a really good point. I think especially in the northern part of the state, the larger providers were using census data as it was collected, and census data is taken usually in the springtime, where our populations, because of tourism, have this doubling effect during certain points of the year. So if communities made the case a little bit stronger about the real need and the potential users, and making the picture a little bit stronger because of ability for the communities to say that there's more people during certain times, it paints a different picture of need. And that communication and working with a smaller provider and maybe doubling with a larger provider for different exposure to different, you know, like with broadband and cellular coverage, then we'll be able to get to the point where we have adequate coverage.
Brittany, where is high-speed internet typically more affordable in the state?
I think there's pockets. I've heard a little bit about Madison being one of those places. There have been really good cooperatives managing some of the work on the northern side of northwestern side of the state. But there are absolutely areas where the cost of broadband and the quality do not actually meet up. And I would also say in dense urban environments, the accessibility and the affordability are also something that we have to be thinking about as well. So it's not just rural. Mm-hmm. We have to be looking about the whole entire state.
Let's bring in David now in Boscobel. David, hi.
Hi. I've worked in telecommunications since the mid-80s, so I have grown up deploying broadband networks. And one comment I have is the discussion earlier about, is there enough competition? I mean, the simple fact of the matter is, and your guest said it correctly, it is so expensive to deploy these networks in rural areas. The focus needs to first be on getting broadband in the rural areas, and then you can start talking about, is there enough effective competition? Because it is so expensive. And I live in a CenturyLink area 3 miles from town, and I can get no broadband access whatsoever, not even dial-up. So,
David, what makes it
satellite or nothing?
What makes deployment so expensive in rural areas?
Density. When you've got something like 5 to 8 customers per square mile, and it costs $15,000 a mile just to put the fiber optic cable in the ground, and then you've got all of your electronics on top of it, and then you expect it to, you know, collect $40 a month from your customer. It just takes a significant amount of time to get a modicum of payback on that investment that goes in the ground. So terrain makes a big difference. If you have hills and rocks, Southwest Wisconsin's a beautiful area, and a lot of people want to live there, but trying to serve that is very, very expensive.
David, thank you for bringing this perspective. Brittany, what would you like to add?
I think he's absolutely right, and that's where you have to bring back that part of the state being a partner inside of this. So if it's a real necessity that the state has discovered that broadband is absolutely a necessity, they should then say to all of the providers, large or small, we'll be a partner in building out the fiber optic cables in this whole entire state so that we can all benefit from it. So that's the right role that the state can be playing. And yes, they are. There's $48 million from the last budget. I'm sure something will happen in the future budgets, but let's really think about this as a partnership and making sure that every single resident of the state of Wisconsin really has access to broadband.
Okay, in the seconds we have left, a 24-member task force. When do you meet?
We're supposed to meet later this summer as the first meeting. So a lot of right now is the preparation and trying to think about scope of work and making sure to reach out to as many of the different task force members. Personally, I'm doing that. But there are so many people who are experts in this field and have something to add to the table. So I am absolutely all ears as we enter this whole entire endeavor.
Brittany, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Brittany Beyer is Executive Director of the Grow North Regional Economic Development Corporation. She was appointed by Governor Evers to lead this new task force on broadband access. Coming up, the State Capitol Report continues with Department of Workforce Development Secretary Caleb Brossman here. How do you feel about the state's handling of unemployment claims? What questions do you have for Secretary Brossman? And what is the status of your claim? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll have more State Cap after this news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Congress is debating another economic stimulus package as a lifeline for people out of work is set to expire. About a month ago, we talked with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. He tamped down any notion that Wisconsin would continue the $600 weekly federal payments with state dollars.
We should know sometime in July the actual state of our budget, but we certainly don't have the ability to replace the money that the federal government's borrowed.
Meanwhile, a state claims processing backlog. Tens of thousands of Wisconsinites still await unemployment benefits. Are you in the adjudication process with your claim being investigated? Are you unclear of the status of your claim? How has the system worked for you? We're at 800-642-1234. Caleb Frostman is Secretary of the State Department of Workforce Development. Secretary Frostman, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Kate, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Why does a backlog of claims still exist 19 weeks after the initial surge in filings?
Good question. So there's a couple different things. I've been obviously a lot of sleepless nights staring at the ceiling and thinking about the things that we're working on and some of the factors involved. And, you know, first and foremost, it's been an extraordinary number of claims that have come through in Wisconsin. Through last week, we received about 4.6 million weeks of unemployment claimed in the state. And that compares to about 1.6 million in all of last year. So in 4 months' time, we had about three times as many claims. And then second is Wisconsin's got a really complicated set of UI laws that determine what needs to be adjudicated as far as eligibility in this state. And so that's a real challenge to dig through all those complicated laws for that many people. And then third is just the thing we've talked about a lot also is our IT infrastructure. So the three pieces there that, are influencing this, really are, creating that situation where we've got more claims than ever before. And then saddled with a really complicated set of laws that determine who needs to be adjudicated and who doesn't. And then you throw on the top of that a 50-year-old IT mainframe. We've got some pretty serious challenges to work through. We're making progress, which is great.
All right. So looking at the adjudication, which is that investigation process, it typically takes 21 days to go through that. What is it taking now?
So I think on an average, and this includes people that are get through right away that don't include adjudication, our average is 22 days. But for adjudication, it's a little bit longer. I don't have the exact number, but it's definitely longer than that 22 days. And we are working in order of oldest claims first, which is getting those folks that have claimed earlier on paid more quickly, which also helps release later weeks, because if we adjudicate a claim, it's for every week that someone has claimed. So if someone started one earlier, we clear all weeks at the same time. So that is having the effect of getting those earliest weeks paid first. But, it's certainly longer than it's been before, based on that incredible volume that we're seeing.
When will DWD catch up?
So we're hopeful both on a return to timeliness, getting back to that 21 days, getting back to a place where we can return vendors. So we've brought on three different vendors, you know, totaling multiple hundred people. I think around eight or 900 vendor staff, and then also get through some of the federal programs for which folks are applying. Somewhere in the end of summer timeframe, where we've been quoted as August through October for different timeliness pieces, the return of our vendors. But we're looking at that end of summer timeframe. Like I said, August to October for turning back vendors, and probably somewhere in the middle of that.
All right, let's take a call now. Tammy is with us from Mason. Tammy, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today? I hope you're safe.
Yes, you too, Tammy. What is your question?
Okay, I got a question. Okay, I'm married, and I don't live with my husband. We're doing that stuff. But he gets his benefits before me, and I got two children. I don't even get food share, no health care, nothing. And so why is that?
And Tammy, are you on Social Security disability insurance?
No. I'm just on SSI.
You're just on SSI. Okay. And
he's on SSI, and he gets all these benefits, and I don't get anything.
All right, Secretary Frostman, any insights?
Sure. I mean, everyone's case is going to be different. We've got different specifics that require adjudication, some that don't. And so generally speaking, and this is just an average, but on any given week, about 75% of new or weekly claims are resolved, whether they're paid or denied, and that 25% gets held. And that depends on someone's work history, the circumstances of their separations from work in the last 18 months. And so a lot of those folks do receive payment within sometimes a week of their weekly claim or their initial claim if they file and are approved, whereas some other folks might have multiple separations that need to be adjudicated. So it really depends on each person's individual circumstance and how Wisconsin law relates to what needs to be adjudicated.
We're on the cusp of the end of the $600 weekly unemployment benefits that expire at the end of the month. Should Congress extend those benefits?
Sure. And they actually expired on Saturday.
Saturday.
At least. Yeah, for FPUC, which is an extra $600 a week. And Governor Evers and this administration are in support of extending the FPUC program in Wisconsin. Whether you get unemployment insurance or the federal program PUA, the maximum you can get is $370 a week. And so it's hard to imagine many Wisconsin families being able to manage and stay afloat on a maximum of $370 a week. And it's not just those families, it's our community's economy that rely on that consumer spending, and so it's really challenging to envision 8, 9, or 10% of Wisconsin's workforce being unemployed and trying to A, keep themselves afloat, and B, keep our state's economy afloat on only $370 a week. So we've been supportive of extending the FPUC program as is at the $600 a week to help keep our economy afloat. And we've seen, of course, different proposals come from different houses out in D.C. and the White House as well. So we're hopeful that FPUC can be extended as is, so we can keep Wisconsin's families and our economy afloat.
We've heard from our callers and guests concerns about this benefit, discouraging workers from returning to their jobs. Here's Chef Luke Zong from the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua.
I have some employees that are making more consistent money and steady money than they did when they were working. And I don't think that that's, Ruthie and I really carry that piece in our heart, but that's, we actually pay pretty well for our restaurant.
So, Secretary, are unemployment benefits hurting our economy's ability to bounce back?
So I think it's a balance. And when we talk about, the inputs into gross domestic product, consumer spending is a big piece of that. And that's one of the pieces that we want to keep as steady as possible. And it's interesting when you look, if someone gets the maximum, if they get the maximum in the state, comes out to about $24 an hour if you do that over the course of a year. But that doesn't include an employer retirement contribution, doesn't include any health insurance contribution. And in Wisconsin, if you refuse to return to work, that makes you ineligible for unemployment insurance. And so, people, if they have to make it on that dollar amount with all of those other considerations, and also knowing that FPUC is temporary, we've had discussions with employers around the state about, we have to make sure that wages are competitive, and that if people really are if that is the case, and we certainly haven't conceded that, but if that is the case, then folks need to take a close, long, hard look at their wages to make sure that they're competitive. And the other important piece, two pieces about FPUCs: one, it was meant to be a stimulus in nature, and two, it's meant to be temporary. So if folks are still making the decision knowing that FPUC is not going to be going on forever, then I think there's some further looking that needs to happen.
Talking about the economy and unemployment with Caleb Frostman, head of the State Department of Workforce Development. Let's take another call now. Ray is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Hi, I'm a union member, and years back I used unemployment during the downtimes of the year. And unemployment at that time had a kind of a quick way to file each week. If from the previous week you still have not worked at all, everything is, all your questions you're going to answer are the exact same from the week before. Unemployment here in Wisconsin would send you a numerical code that you could put into the website so you didn't have to answer the same 20 silly questions every week that you are answering the same way. Like for me now, it's the last 4 months. As a stagehand, we have not worked a single day in 4 months, but every week I got to go to the website and answer these same silly 20 questions, which are the exact same from last week. Why did you get rid of that shortcut for us?
Secretary?
So I don't have a great answer for that. I don't know the specifics of what the caller is talking about as far as that code or what has changed or when it changed, but we certainly, it's our position that, unemployment insurance should be really straightforward and uncomplicated. And if you're out of work through no fault of your own, that should be the litmus test as to your eligibility. And so we certainly continue to look at all of our online claims portals for new claims, for older claims, or sorry, for recurring claims, and, what that burden looks like for claimants, and certainly want to make that as simple as possible going forward.
State Senator Dale Coinga suggests that Wisconsin use virtual agents to handle simple claims questions in like Colorado is doing. What do you sense there with virtual agents?
We did implement a chatbot relatively early in this process. I think it came on either in May or June, I don't recall, but the chatbot has been utilized answering a lot of questions, the more simple questions regarding eligibility, some of the determinants of eligibility, how to file one's claim. And so we've seen decent usage on that chatbot. And then, part of our ramping up as far as staffing efforts have been on some of those, the call agents have been split up into two tiers, one of which is more simple answers and questions, the other being more complicated. And we do have more at this point, more people on that tier one, which is your more easily answerable questions, helping people understand the application process. And so we've been doing our best to make sure we can provide good customer service for all those folks out there filing for UI.
We have Workforce Development Secretary Caleb Frostman on the line as we discuss the backlog of unemployment claims. Have you tried calling the unemployment benefit hotline? Are you clear on the status of your claim? Has filing a claim been seamless for you? Do you have tips for filing unemployment claims for others? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap here on the Ideas Network. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's continue our conversation now with Workforce Development Secretary Caleb Frostman. His agency has come under criticism in recent months for not keeping up with the deluge of unemployment claims that was caused by the economic fallout from the pandemic. Let's take another call now. Mike is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Howdy. I used to work for DWD. I work for somebody else now. Since Act 10, state wages have fallen further and further behind inflation. A lot of people who had planned on continuing a career with the state have retired or gone somewhere where they can get paid better and be respected more. And now you're hiring all these vendors, which is a euphemism for temp agencies, who are amateurs. They are outsiders. They are, in some cases, I am told by people who are still with DWD, they're clowns. They do not have the training and expertise that the people you have lost over the years had, or the people that you managed to retain still have. And I'd like to see that addressed in terms of improved wages and not having a situation where you're treated as a temp yourself.
Mike, thank you. Secretary Frostman, can you explain more about these vendors and the work crisis perhaps inside DWD itself?
Sure. Well, we've brought on, when we started COVID-19, we had about 500 employees in unemployment insurance in DWD. Since that time, including hires into the department, some intergovernmental reassignments, and bringing on vendors, that number has risen to about 1,900, so we've almost quadrupled. And of course, the vendors we brought on are meant to be temporary in nature, but we have hired 325 people into the agency. And it is, you know, about most important to us, and that's evidenced by the governor's first two executive orders talking about the dignity and the importance of state employees. And our employees are our best resource. And in our darkest days, when we're, you know, stressed out and under fire, I can't help but feel grateful for the ingenuity, the endurance, the selflessness and humility of our staff to do this work day in and day out for less than wonderful wages under public scrutiny. And they do this work because they care and they want to help people. And, you know, as a leader of this agency, that's, I think, what I'm most grateful for is the people we work with. But we had to bring on additional people, lots of them, very quickly to deal with the deluge. And our vendors, whether it's adjudication, claims processing around the phones, have been great partners, and they are meant to be temporary in nature.
How much oversight do you have of the vendors and the work they do?
Quite a bit. So we have meetings with them, you know, if not every day, multiple times a week to make sure we're monitoring their output, whether that's our large call center, our smaller call center for PUA applicants, or another vendor that does claims processing and adjudication for us. We watch their productivity very closely and adjust on the fly as necessary for all of our vendors.
And in training up these 325 people you've brought into DWD, how are you doing this training? How are you getting them up to speed?
That's a great question. And we've had, you know, to Mike's call, we've got some of the greatest, you know, state employees in all the nation, but definitely, you know, within the state working at DWD. And so they've been, you know, accelerating certain training timeframes, and we've got our best people, you know, training the trainers so we can kind of replicate that across our internal hires, our vendors. But that's been, you know, a part of the on-ramp process is finding these candidates, hiring them, training them, and then making sure that the people that are doing the training can still do productive work. So they're not just training all the time, but we're trying to be as efficient as possible to train trainers, to replicate processes. And we have, in some cases, been able to accelerate some of those training regimens for our new hires.
State Senator John Erpenbach said the state should transfer even more workers to handle claims and expand call center hours. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss echoed those points with us last month.
The idea that we're only going to have traditional business hours, 7:30 until 5, when we have hundreds of thousands of claims waiting, is something that would never occur under a Republican administration, because we would say, look, let's work double shifts. Let's pay people overtime.
Secretary Frostman, can call center hours be expanded?
So we have expanded our call center hours. We started earlier this year, even before COVID-19, our hours were about 7:35 to 3:30. But it's important to note that a lot of work happens after those call center hours end. But since that time, we've expanded them to from 6:15 in the morning until, I believe, 5:30 in the evening. And again, you know, we have a lot of processes that happen after that last 5:30, we have callbacks have to happen. We clear the queue. So that's when we stop taking new calls. Calls continue to happen past that time. And then we have to put our batch together for payment processing, which needs to occur before the ACH deadline each day for our banks to process payments for claimants. So we have expanded that. And I think the biggest piece for us has been expanding our staff so we can expand our capacity to do work on behalf of claimants. We needed to add more people and to train them, because if we didn't do that before expanding hours, we would just answer the same number of phone calls over a longer period of time. So now we have longer periods of time in which we are answering a higher volume of calls. So, you know, that was a dual a parallel path where we had to add additional staff, train them, after which we could certainly expand hours, and we have.
We're discussing unemployment with Workforce Development Secretary Caleb Frostman, handling jobless claims and providing work search programs. Let's take another call now. Frank is joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Frank.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is whether you allow staff to call back when, through no fault of their own, the person calling in gets cut off. After waiting more than almost 2 hours for a Tier 1 rep, my situation was then forwarded to a Tier 2 rep, and they took the same information, all your ID, including your phone number, and then before we could get something resolved, my question resolved, I got disconnected. So I lost 2 hours without anything getting resolved, and I expected, well, they've got my phone number. Are they going to call me back? And they never did, so I gave up. Mm. So are they allowed to call you back? They've got your information.
Secretary?
Sure. So we have been scheduling callbacks from our DWD staff. And Frank, I'm sorry you got dropped. And we've been trying to make sure that those transfers are quicker. And they have improved drastically over the last few weeks. Generally speaking, on any given day, with the exception of sometimes Monday, we are answering more phone calls than people are calling us or talking to multiple people multiple times a day. And we've seen a precipitous drop in our call wait times. But one of the requirements for our call centers, we wanted to be able to schedule callbacks. But we can certainly look into if someone is specifically dropped. I don't know what the protocol is to make a phone call back. We certainly schedule them back at times when people have availability. But we can certainly look into that.
Earlier this month, there was the report from the Legislative Audit Bureau that found that a glitch caused about $21 million to be overpaid in benefits, and DWD says many of the payments were recovered. What steps is the department taking to prevent future errors?
Sure. So we've since onboarded two new federal programs, and our testing prior to launching FPUC showed no glitches, showed no errors, and obviously that wasn't the case. We've been doing more thorough testing on federal programs as they come through, kind of a belt and suspenders approach to make sure that doesn't happen again. We've also implemented policies at the suggestion of myself, of DOA, of LAB, to make sure that those type of errors don't happen again.
Republicans and Democrats in the legislature unveiled proposals, addressing the issues here. Republicans want the state to issue forgivable loans to people waiting weeks for their claims. Do you support that step?
So we're really focused on DWD paying every eligible claim as quickly as possible. And so our resources of time and energy are focused on making sure that we process the claims that are in the queue and get that caseload back to timeliness and making sure that folks get paid as quickly as possible.
Really quickly here, Governor Evers ordered state agencies to cut $250 million in spending because of lower tax collections. Will DWD be affected by these cuts?
So we've continued to talk to DOA and to all of our partner agencies. And I think a lot of agencies have difficult discussions to make. I know the governor commented on this last week. And with the economic impacts of COVID, it definitely affects our revenues. So I anticipate we'll have some tough decisions to make, and DWD will maybe be in that group. But we continue to talk to the budget office, DOA, and the governor's team to make the most fiscally responsible decisions as possible.
Secretary Frostman, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kate. Have a great day.
You too. Caleb Frostman, Secretary of the State Department of Workforce Development. Just ahead, we learn about a national research project aimed at studying the coronavirus and other diseases. Are you participating in the All of Us Research Project? What questions do you hope researchers tackle? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.